The News.
Israeli forces storm a major hospital in southern Gaza Strip, asking displaced people and crew there to evacuate at gunpoint. The Hamas Political Bureau chief says the Palestinian priority is to stop brutal aggression against Gaza and the complete withdrawal of occupation forces. And the U.S. president says he's decided on a response to recent deadly drone strike on a U.S. base in Jordan, but doesn't want a wider war in the Middle East. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on World News. There's no end in sight to Israeli atrocities in Gaza. Israeli forces have now stormed Al-Amal Hospital in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, demanding displaced people there evacuate at gunpoint. Palestinian Red Crescent says people are in severe danger there, with a civilian already killed near the hospital. Al-Amal Hospital, which is in Khan Yunis, along with the Al-Nasser Medical Complex, have been under Israeli siege and tank fire for over a week. Regime forces have struck ambulances marked with Red Cross or Red Crescent emblems. Meanwhile, an Israeli airstrike targeted a home in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, leaving 11 people dead and many injured. Overall death toll from Israeli aggression now stands at more than 26,700. Muti Abu Musaba joined us earlier with an update on the situation in the war-torn enclave.
It's the same scenario that took place in the Shifa complex and the hospitals of the northern parts of Gaza Strip. It's now reiterated in Khan Yunis city, which means that the Israeli occupation forces systematically attempting to paralyze the health sector and collapse the health sector inside Gaza Strip. In the surrounding areas of the complex, these moments and over the last couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks. The Israeli airstrikes have never stopped for a while the Israeli artillery maintained their constant shelling towards those areas, while the Israeli occupation forces on the ground demanding the Palestinian people to evacuate from those areas to Rafah and to Deir al-Balah city, under the claims that those areas are still safe. In Rafah city, the Israeli occupation forces as well kept attacking the city, and they opened their fire to the eastern parts of the city.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says any deal with Israel must stop brutal aggression on Gaza and result in the complete withdrawal of occupation forces. Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh said the movement is open to talks, but an agreement must include an end to Israeli siege as well as genuine prisoner exchange. He made the remarks in reaction to a new ceasefire proposal put forward after talks in Paris. Meanwhile, Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement also said it will not engage in any prisoner exchange deal without a comprehensive ceasefire and Israel's complete withdrawal from Gaza. Shocking story, Israeli undercover forces carried out a deadly attack on a hospital in the occupied West Bank, assassinating three Palestinians. Troops disguised as medical staff and women stormed Ibn Sina Hospital in the city of Jenin. Israel has claimed the victims had ties to Hamas. Hospital officials say young men were assassinated while they were sleeping. But following that raid, a general strike's been announced in Jenin. The Palestinian Health Ministry has also called on the United Nations to stop Israel's daily string of crimes against the Palestinian people and their health centers. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry described it as a heinous crime against humanity. Hamas has also denounced the attack, saying it will not go unpunished. Iran has strongly condemned what it called barbaric act, saying it will pave the way for normalization of organized terrorism in the world. Spokesman for the Al-Quds Brigades, that's the military wing of the Islamic Jihad movement, says Israel's threats to continue its onslaught in Gaza have no effect on determination of resistance groups. Abu Hamza dismissed the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's war threats as futile. He said Israeli captives will only be released once resistance factions decide. Abu Hamza also reported the downing of numerous Israeli drones and the targeting of Israeli supply lines by resistance fighters. Meanwhile, the military wing of Hamas said it targeted several Israeli tanks and Khan units in southern Gaza. Kuwait has been calling on the international community to take a strong position on the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. This urgent plea was voiced during an emergency Arab League meeting in Cairo, with further support reiterated in the Kuwaiti parliament.
In a display of solidarity, 36 members out of 50 in the Kuwaiti National Assembly have called on the government to urgently convene a session of the United Nations Human Rights Council. The aim is to address the ongoing atrocities in the Gaza Strip, a move driven by Kuwait's strong support for Palestine in the wake of the recent ruling by the International Court of Justice on Israeli genocide in Gaza. In light of growing concerns about the genocide committed by Israel in Gaza, Kuwaiti lawmakers have underscored the urgent necessity to address the suffering inflicted by Israel.
Kuwait's position has not changed since the beginning. That's why Kuwait has now asked for an urgent humanitarian session in the Human Rights Council because of what Israel is committing in Palestine. Kuwait has not yet led the way to file a lawsuit, but instead has given documented evidence against Israel to South Africa. The International Court of Justice decision is a first step toward a world that sees Israel as a criminal, not a victim.
A coalition of Kuwaiti and Arab lawmakers has proposed assisting South Africa in safeguarding Palestinians against war crimes. They affirmed Kuwait's steadfast solidarity with global advocacy for Palestinian rights and justice. The Kuwaiti proposed initiative seeks to mobilize international support for Palestine while holding Israel accountable for its actions in Gaza. It underscores Kuwait's unwavering commitment to upholding human rights principles. This united stance displays Kuwait's determination to confront injustice and support the oppressed. It also serves as a strong message to the international community that there should be no impunity for those who commit crimes against humanity.
Kuwait's robust backing for Palestine is evident across different sectors in the country. And the new government here in Kuwait has prioritized actions against the atrocities that are taking place in Gaza by the Israelis. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City.
A senior Yemeni official has dismissed U.S. threats to intensify attacks in the country in response to anti-Israel operations in the Red Sea in support of Gaza. Mohammed Ali Al-Houthi, a senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, said U.S. has sent threatening messages through Oman. He warned the U.S. against any adventurism, saying all threats against the Yemeni people are doomed to fail. Houthi added, no move by the enemy will deter the Yemeni people from implementing their mission in support of the people of Gaza. The Yemeni army has been targeting Israeli-operated or Israeli-bound vessels in the Red Sea over the past several weeks in response to the regime's campaign of genocide in Gaza. It's also been targeting American and British ships, and that's in retaliation for U.S.-UK aggression against Yemen. The U.S. president says he does not think a wider war is needed in the Middle East. Joe Biden said he has decided on a response to recent drone strike in Jordan that left three U.S. troops dead. Biden said he holds Iran responsible for supplying weapons for that attack. Tehran, however, has rejected as baseless the U.S. accusations linking the Islamic Republic to attacks on American facilities and personnel. Tehran says that the Islamic Republic does not directly or indirectly control any group or individual in the region and is not responsible for their actions. Iran, however, has repeatedly warned about the consequences of the ongoing U.S.-Israeli war on Gaza. And China has warned the U.S. against further fueling tensions in the region following that deadly attack on U.S. military base in Jordan.
We have noticed reports of casualties caused by the attack on the U.S. military base. We have also noted that Iran stated that it had nothing to do with the attack. The situation in the Middle East is currently highly complex and sensitive. We hope that all relevant parties will remain calm and restrained, strengthen dialogue and communication, avoid falling into a vicious cycle of retaliation, and prevent further escalation of regional tensions.
The Chinese spokesman made the remarks after U.S. vowed to respond to the attacks on its base in Jordan. Kremlin also called for de-escalation of tensions, with Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov saying that Russia believes overall level of tension is very alarming and now is the time to take steps for de-escalation. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the sanctions and animosity of ill-wishers can be an opportunity for further scientific progress. In a meeting with economic players and producers, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said such problems undoubtedly deal a blow to the country. However, leader added, younger generations turn these problems into opportunities as they've been able to develop military munitions or secure outstanding scientific achievements in areas such as the space sector. Ayatollah Khamenei added, had it not been for the sanctions, Iran wouldn't have achieved such accomplishments. Iran's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador to Tehran over London's accusations against the Islamic Republic. Ministry conveyed Tehran's strong protest at, quote, unfounded accusations and illegal sanctions leveled against Iran by the United Kingdom. Ministry described as destructive London's attempts to tarnish Iran's image, adding such measures will not succeed. On Monday, UK imposed sanctions on a number of Iranian officials, claiming individuals are connected with networks engaged in targeting anti-Iran dissidents residing in other countries. Meanwhile, Iran's defense ministry says the country's space program is completely scientific to develop technology for civil and peaceful purposes. Spokesman for the Space Department at Iran's defense ministry, Ahmad Hosseini, reiterated Tehran's legitimate right to make scientific advancement in aerospace. Hosseini also censured negative reactions to Iran's breakthroughs in this field and recent successful launch of multiple satellites into space. He says such reactions are due to some countries' concerns about Iran breaking up monopolies in the field. He also revealed Iran will launch more satellites in the near future. On Sunday, for the first time, Iran managed to place three indigenous satellites into orbit simultaneously using a Seymour carrier rocket. Iran and Pakistan have vowed to jointly fight common threat of terrorism. Announcement signals efforts to rebuild ties following missile attacks on each other's border regions. Yusuf Misha Ahmadi has your story.
Vowing to fight the common threat of terrorism and reiterating their commitment to improving bilateral relations, Iran and Pakistan are back on the right track to boost ties following tit-for-tat missile attacks on each other's border regions, where terrorist separatist groups have been active.
We are saying this loud and clear for the terrorists to listen carefully. Iran and Pakistan will not allow terrorists to create insecurity in the region. Make no mistake, we are one nation in two different geographical areas, and both sides strongly respect each other's territorial integrity.
In Islamabad, in response to his Pakistani counterpart's official invitation, Hossein Amir Abdullahian discussed ways to fight against the terrorists based along the Iran-Pakistan border areas that are, in his words, supported by hostile third countries. Many Iranian and Pakistani forces have lost their lives in recent years in the fight against terrorism, and over the past 2 weeks, both Iran and Pakistan inevitably launched missile attacks on each other's soil in order to contain the terrorist separatist groups, a move that created a media frenzy. And now this official visit is clearing things out.
You need to understand that in the last 70 years or so, Pakistan and Iran have developed a robust cooperation between themselves. We have strong people-to-people contacts. We have religious ties. We have historical ties. We have cultural ties between our two countries. And these ties are extremely important for our two countries to have a common security and common development, peace and prosperity for each other. I think the important thing for us is that there is a strong sentiment in Pakistan that peace and prosperity and security of Iran is something which is extremely important for Pakistan and for the region. And we have very strong reason to believe that Iran is also motivated by the same sentiment.
Views that were reiterated by Pakistan's Chief of Army Staff, General Sayed Asim Munir, as well as Pakistan's Prime Minister, Anwar ul Haq Kakar, who urged joint efforts, more coordination, and intelligence sharing to fight terrorism as a common threat to both countries, while also extending an official invitation for the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to travel to Islamabad.
Iran and Pakistan are turning a new page, and the Iranian foreign minister's trip to Islamabad is a sign that both sides are adamant in expanding their bilateral relations. Gisumi Shahmadi, Islamabad.
Iran has officially taken part for a first time in a meeting of the BRICS group of emerging economies in Russia less than a month after joining the economic bloc as a full member. The deputy foreign ministers of the bloc's 10 member countries are participating in this event. During the three-day meeting in Moscow, representatives from Iran, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Ethiopia are to exchange views on BRICS plans for 2024. Meanwhile, diplomats from Russia, China, Brazil, India, and South Africa are in attendance as delegates of the founding members of the bloc. Iran applied for full membership into BRICS back in June of 2022 and became an official member of the bloc at the beginning of this year, along with the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Ethiopians, Argentinians, and Egyptians. And now Canadian Muslim leaders have abruptly canceled a meeting with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau over his support for the Israeli regime and failure to take tangible action against Islamophobia in the country. Stephen Brown, CEO of the National Council of Canadian Muslims, slammed Canada's refusal to call on Tel Aviv to follow orders set out by the International Court of Justice aimed at preventing genocide in Gaza. He said that decision is a straw that broke the camel's back. He said there is no evidence Ottawa is willing to pressure Israel to ease the bombings of Gaza. Brown also said Trudeau has broken promises of fighting anti-Muslim hate crimes that he gave to the Muslim community back in 2015. Meeting was due to be held on the 7th anniversary of the Quebec mosque shooting, in which 6 people were killed and 19 injured back in 2017. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The impunity enjoyed by the Zionist regime troops determined to kill Palestinian children is bought and paid for by the Biden administration, which refuses to hold the Zionist regime forces to account for carrying out genocide in Gaza. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, recently a drone-fired missile struck 4 Palestinians, including 3 children during a raid into the Tulkarm refugee camp, killing all of them. The Zionist regime forces then prevented ambulances from reaching them for about an hour and a half. The three 17-year-old boys were named as Ahmad Tariq Faraj, Walid Ibrahim Ghanem, and Ahmad Musa Bedu by DCIP's investigation. The raid in Tul Karm lasted 45 hours, during which Israeli regime troops killed 8 Palestinians and injured at least 26. The Zionist regime army claimed to have found and confiscated weaponry. The Zionist regime troops destroyed dozens of vehicles and vandalized Palestinian homes and shops in the camp. In a pattern of recent West Bank raids, bulldozers destroyed the camp's streets and alleys. The Zionist regime officials say bulldozers destroyed roads and infrastructure to uproot makeshift bombs planted underground to attack the invaders when they entered the camp. UN monitoring group OCHA said at least 21 homes were rendered uninhabitable due to explosions and bulldozing, displacing 137 people, including 46 children, in Nur Sharm and Tul Karm refugee camps. The Zionist regime forces kidnapped hundreds of Palestinians, transferred them from one place to another, and interrogated them after holding them for hours. Detainees were tied by the hands, assaulted and beaten by the Zionist regime forces. Israeli raids have intensified in Tul Karm and its two refugee camps, Nur Shams and Tul Karm, since October 7th. Massive damage has been caused to their infrastructure by Israeli bulldozers. A local healthcare worker told the Electronic Intifada earlier this month, the Nur Shams camp is just like Gaza. Hundreds of meters of the main highway outside the camp had been destroyed. The Guardian reported on the same refugee camp, adding, so too had the road into the camp where a social and sports club once stood. There was rubble. A wedding hall had been half reduced to ruins. Walls were pocked with shrapnel and bullets, cars, water pipes were shattered, and electricity lines trailed. The Zionist regime had already been setting the West Bank on fire before October 7th. A number of small armed resistance groups emerged in response to the Zionist regime's increasing attacks on the occupied West Bank towns, villages, and refugee camps, and Zionist settlement expansion in the years leading up to the recent military operation. The Jenin Brigade formed in the Jenin refugee camp. It's a group associated with Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad resistance group, while the Lion's Den, a group of Palestinians from different political factions within its ranks, appeared in Nablus. All those camps had graduated multiple generations of fierce armed resistance fighters throughout the first and second intifadas. West Bank has been described as a third front of Israeli regime attacks after its genocide in Gaza and fighting in the north with Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. Since October 7th, the fabricated regime of Israel has routinely conducted prolonged military raids in towns, cities, and refugee camps across the West Bank to try to stifle the armed resistance. They have also caused extensive damage to refugee camps, streets, homes, commercial areas, as well as water, electricity and road infrastructure has been devastated due to successive Israeli regime raids in those areas. Raids last long hours, sometimes days, during which the Zionist regime forces storm homes of Palestinians and arrest them. The Zionist regime forces often kill Palestinians, including children, during raids. Zionist regime army has also been conducting aerial attacks in the West Bank on a near regular basis. This was a practice it revived last year, but had previously not been used since the Second Intifada 2 decades ago. The Zionist regime troops have killed at least 350 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since October 7th, and at least 8 were killed by Zionist settlers, the UN monitoring group OCHA has reported. Of those killed, 94 were children.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone. For your information, once when the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, was asked about the best and the worst creations of God, he answered, "Wording is the best and the worst thing that God created. By means of wording, some faces become white, and by means of wording, some faces become black."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson: Gossip, Paradise, and Satan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Look around. Is there any believer who wouldn't want to enter paradise? Just ask around. Every one of us would love to end up in paradise. Isn't that right? But there are certain traits that some develop which become a hurdle in one's ability to enter the paradise. The Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, said, "The talebearer will not enter paradise." So somebody who does gossip, who goes around and makes stories about other believers, they will not enter paradise. And who is a talebearer? It is someone who makes up stories about others to depict them in a negative light. They are the ones that cause damage to other believers. They do gossip and as a result become entitled to the punishment of Allah. The Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, said in one place, "The talebearer will not be relieved from the punishment of Allah in the hereafter." We know that the one who makes up imaginary stories to defame believers is bad. But what about the person who listens to such a person? Well, again, let's turn to the Prophet of Allah. And he, in one of his speeches, he said, "One should not gossip, nor should one listen to the talebearers." Look, brothers and sisters, the instructions from the Holy Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, are very clear. He is not only refraining us from making up stories regarding other believers, especially the false stories, God forbid. At the same time, he's saying, don't give ears to those stories. You know, sometimes we feel that I'm not the one who's saying that. I'm not the one who's making up these stories. I'm not the one who is the cause of defamation of a mu'min or a believer. And hence, it's okay. I'm fine. Well, this is not the case. When it comes to Islam, Islam does not in any capacity want you to be part of this whole process of the defamation of a believer. So the Prophet of Allah says that do not even listen to gossip. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing gossip, paradise, and Satan. So before the break, we talked about briefly about how doing gossip is something discouraged in Islam by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, by the Prophet, by the Quran. And at the same time, listening to gossip, being part of the process of a defamation of a believer, is equally bad. Now, some of us imagine that since we are believers, we will go straight to paradise. Well, there are two things here, really. One is going to paradise. The other is straight to paradise. Well, inshallah, we go straight to paradise. But have you realized that the infallible Imam, the Prophet, and Quran have already informed us that our entrance in the paradise is dependent on certain things? Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam, the sixth divinely appointed Imam, said, "Murderers, habitual drunkards, and those who go to and fro bearing tales will not enter paradise." Now you notice, the Imam, the infallible, immaculate Imam, is saying that this is a precondition if we would like to go to paradise, let alone go straight to paradise, then we must make sure that these things do not exist in our lives. And one of those things is the topic that we're discussing today, bearing tales about other believers. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam also said that four kinds of people will not enter paradise: the soothsayer, the hypocrite, the habitual drunkard, and the talebearer. The vice of being a talebearer, or the one who gossips, puts one in a very difficult situation. In one place, the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, says, "Surely the talebearer is a ray's witness and a companion of Satan."
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome to Israel Watch, which has followed with interest the heavy losses suffered by the occupation army at the hands of Palestinian resistance fighters in the Gaza Strip without achieving any strategic achievement despite the massacres and destruction. In the meantime, we go over the exacerbation of pressure on the Netanyahu administration and the War Council, which come from the families of the Zionist captives in light of internal disputes. This is while the South Lebanon front focuses on the field situation, where Zionist threats against it are escalating after the heavy losses the occupation army and the settlers have suffered. Regarding these topics, I welcome the analyst on Israeli issues, Mr. Khalil Nasrallah. Welcome, dear professor. Let us begin with the most difficult day that the occupation army has experienced in the Gaza Strip since the beginning of the aggression. 24 officers and soldiers were killed at the hands of Palestinian resistance fighters on the most difficult day, according to what the enemy media have described.
Professor Khalil Nasrallah, the occupation army is undergoing difficult days in the Gaza Strip. They have admitted that 24 of their soldiers were killed at the hands of Palestinian resistance fighters. What does this mean?
Thank you very much. It's very clear that many things happen in wars, but the striking Israeli propaganda is trying to mitigate the severity of what happened. The army spokesman presented a statement in two phrases. It seems that a shell was directed at the tank. It seems that the two buildings exploded and our soldiers were booby-trapped. It is not that they are booby-trapping them, because there are conflicting ideas in the media, and this is, by the way, official Israeli announcement. There is no army in the world that booby-traps a building and sits in it. It appears that it is a major operation carried out by the resistance. As long as they admit that a tank was hit by a shell and a soldier was killed, this means that the occupation forces had been lured to buildings. The resistance may have done it. Whoever booby-trapped it, and this matter is not unlikely, the resistance in Gaza is behind it. This is the price of waging wars, and the prices they are paying are very high. The annihilation of this larger number of soldiers is a remarkable thing, and I even believe that this is not a real number. The issue is clear. Imagine that you are in a building with dozens of soldiers. They're talking about dozens of soldiers. Then they talk about 21 dead, and then again they talk about injuries and a few injuries. No, I think things are much bigger than that.
The killing of the occupation army forces is abundant in the Gaza Strip. In addition, they've admitted the killing of 24 officers and soldiers in just one day, while no strategic achievements have been made that can strengthen the settlers in resistance until now. Of course, this was confirmed by Minister Gadia Essenkot, a member of the Zionist War Council, which is leading the aggression against Gaza. Professor Khalil Nasrallah, we hear wholesale confessions from those responsible, from the Zionist leaders, about the failure of the aggression against the Gaza Strip in achieving its goals so far. What does it mean for us to issue this confession from Gadia Essenkot, and of course, he is a member of the War Council, at a time when the occupation army only admitted to the killing of 24 officers and soldiers in one day, and you say that number is likely to collide?
As for Gadi Essenkot, he is a double failure. Firstly, he is a proponent of the Dahiya Doctrine, and they have now implemented it in Gaza. This is a very important point. The failure of all the war councils, with its opponents and proponents, this affects everyone at the end. There is a consensus not only in the regime, but also among the Americans and the Europeans that the military operation in the Gaza Strip has failed to achieve the goals. Things speak for themselves, and the conflict now is between two points. About the deal, Essenkot calls for an exchange deal. They have two problems. The problem is that they are stuck between the inability to continue the war and the inability to stop the war. Therefore, now the point is that, as some Israeli leaks are trying to talk about, a gradual process of ceasing the war is on the agenda. However, this matter is rejected by the resistance and renewed its rejection.
The occupation forces are drowning in the Gaza quagmire without strategic successes that can change the reality. This reminds the Zionists of the Americans who drowned in Iraq. So, Professor Khalil Nasrallah, the occupation armies drowned in the Gaza quagmire, just as the American forces were drowned in the Iraq quagmire. What do these Zionist statements indicate, in your opinion?
There is a difference between drowning and drown. I mean, their description about the situation is correct. They have drowned the Gaza Strip. From the beginning, there was a problem with going for the ground operation. It is true that they had a certain perception, but of course, matters became different on the ground, and things were not expected to reach this point. We are witnessing the results as we talk about their failure. When it comes to achievements, we know that the failure of the ground operation is the reason why they have not achieved any of the goals. The Israeli ground forces entered areas in the Gaza Strip, in the north of the Strip, for example, and after they announced that they were done with that region and left, the resistance reorganized. Of course, they immediately restored forces because among the martyrs there were some leaders, but the missile strikes returned from the north. They returned to the Gaza Strip and entered some points. The resistance has avoided the predicament and everything the occupation army did, including bombing, destruction, and ground entry. None of them caused any change, defeat, or retreat in the resistance. Rather, it became more proactive in more ways than usual. In the coming days, they will talk more about getting drowned, and what happened in the operation of central Gaza in Al-Maghazi is a sign of that. This is an indication of the extent of their drowning.
Hezbollah has not yet used 1% of its military combat capabilities on the front it opened on the border. These are the words of one of the Zionist intelligence officials. Mr. Khalil Nasrallah, what is this description of the reality of the northern region on the border with southern Lebanon? It seems that Hezbollah only used 1% of its capabilities, especially after the Meron airstrikes, which came in response to the series of assassinations that targeted leaders from the resistance axis, whether in Syria or Lebanon.
Regarding the capabilities of the resistance, what did it use and what did it not use is a serious concern for the Israelis. They do not know the intention, and they do not know much about the issues of what the resistance is launching. They have only estimates, but the resistance does not have this problem. More importantly, if we see the series of operations carried out by the resistance, and I also refer to them as precise operations, that's because they are based on very important intelligence gatherings that goes beyond the issue of being aware of the missiles. Because some say that, for example, the missiles target here and there. The scene that we see is that. But the point is that according to the larger calculations of the war, it'll be costly for the Israelis. What do they talk about? What if they call the settlers for supplies? And what supplies are there in a neighborhood? This is a ridiculous issue. The talk is that the home front must hold out in order for us to win the war. Will the home front hold out? This is a very big question, and yet the Israelis do not know what Hezbollah's intentions are if it goes to war. This is a matter of strikes. I disagree with the statement. It is a very important point because it is related to the fact that in response to the assassinations in Lebanon and Syria, this matter now goes back to the resistance. The assassinations that happened in Syria have affected the resistance axis. The Israelis talk about fighting the axis of resistance, and Netanyahu, in his recent speech, has said, "We have put the head of the snake between two crescents," meaning that Iran is the weapon of the snake, Iran is the one who runs them, Iran is the one who does everything. Therefore, the response from Lebanon was to tell them that it is our decision and the decision has been made in Lebanon, and the transgressions you are making in more than one place would not be allowed in Iran. There were assassinations in Lebanon that took the lives of our young men, and we saw what happened in Kafra and what happened in Bazaria. So the Israelis know the consequences of repeating this path.
However, with the significant increase in the number of deaths and injuries among the occupation soldiers and settlers near the border with southern Lebanon, the occupation authorities reinforced hospitals in the northern region with more medical equipment and supported them with many medical staff. Tamir Pardo, former head of the Mossad, for his part, stressed that the occupation forces were unable to forcibly release the captives from the hands of Palestinian resistance fighters in Gaza, and therefore they lost the war. The families of Zionist captives who had begun an open sit-in in front of Netanyahu's house in occupied Jerusalem or Quds, a group of them stormed the church headquarters and demanded an exchange deal for their release while throwing insults at Netanyahu and members of his administration. The issue of the Zionist families and the protests they are carrying out against the Netanyahu administration has been the subject of comments on Israeli social media, and these are some of them.
Namalakov. Let's block the roads until all the captives return.
Milisoki.
They talk and talk, and no one actually does anything. Shame and disgrace.
Arava.
It is necessary to burn all of Israel until someone in the regime who seems to be sleeping in the winter's slumber wakes up.
Ivan.
We will not stop until Netanyahu concludes an exchange deal.
Orit.
This is a criminal administration that cares nothing about power and rule.
Professor Khalil Nasrallah, this is a criminal regime. There is a clear and extreme resentment towards the Netanyahu administration because of its awkward handling of the captives issue. This is why releasing the captives was among the primary goals of the aggression against the Gaza Strip.
I'm telling you that it is one of the main goals in some way. The dimensions of this war are far beyond an issue. The issue of the captives' families is a reality, and this is a tangible matter. It means that it is not a priority for Netanyahu. The point is that he has never put the problem of the captives' families high on the agenda. This problem is even more serious than the threat to existence for Israelis. Gallant has said that if we do not win this war, our stay here in this region is pointless. Then Benny Gantz will talk about the existential dimension of the war, which means that if they achieve an accomplishment now but fail to return the captives, things will be ugly for the regime. This will lead to immense pressure on the regime if they fail to achieve major goals exactly as happened in July 2006. Hassan Nasrallah commented in one of his interviews that, is it possible that a war of this type would be a response to the killing of 8 soldiers and the capture of 2 others? Continuing, this genocide is not rational. This is an advanced type of barbarism. What happened in July was hostile. It was not proportionate with the goals of the war. The same thing has happened in the Gaza Strip. The bigger goal was to eliminate Hamas. I mean, if the Israelis were really thinking about the issue of the exchange deal, they would have been satisfied, for example, with 15 days of heavy bombardment. But they went far beyond that, and now they have begun to constitute a pressure factor because they have failed to achieve the main goal.
This was reflected everywhere, and the widespread disagreements within Netanyahu's administration and the War Council are no longer hidden. It's being discussed openly in the media, especially between Netanyahu and Gallant. Professor Khalil Nasrallah, the differences are clearly at their most evident between Netanyahu and Gallant, who tried to storm Netanyahu's office even within the administration and the War Council. Today, everyone is against everyone. Why, in time of war, does this mean that disagreements abound? And where can they lead?
First, among the comments, I noticed an important point, that if the War Council disintegrates, there will be 3 groups in Gaza, which means they will not work, so to speak. This indicates the extent of the impact of these differences on the war in the Gaza Strip. Second, there is a disagreement of everyone with everyone. There is a dispute between Gallant and Netanyahu within the Likud party. There are very large disagreements between the leaders of the security services and some of the political staff led by Benjamin Netanyahu. This is also the result of concealments in achieving war goals, eliminating Hamas and killing their leaders.
In your opinion, will this lead to the collapse of the current administration?
Originally, the war council that was formed by the Americans can blow up at any point. Today, like the Americans, they asked Benny Gantz to come out. It blows up the next war council and holds it against Netanyahu's administration. Netanyahu also has problems with some of his ministers in his administration. But the main point is that they constitute a pressure factor. This is the main point. Now, with regard to the legendary war council, because it is different, there are huge divisions between the visions and strategic visions of the council members, as there are conflicts between the various poles in Israel.
Thank you for being with us on this episode of Israel Watch, Mr. Khalil Nasrallah, and thank you for your good wishes. Greetings until we meet again, God willing.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The turn of events in recent months amid the Zionist regime genocidal war on the Gaza Strip has demonstrated to the world the awe-inspiring bravery and heroism of the Yemeni government and its military. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Press TV wrote, the Ansarullah resistance movement, which is currently running the affairs of the Arab country, including its military, has walked out of its way to express solidarity with the people of Palestine. A series of attacks on Israel-linked vessels in the Red Sea, as well as vessels belonging to the US and the UK by the Yemeni military, has prompted major shipping companies to avoid the strategic waterway, inflicting a heavy blow to the Zionist regime's already fledgling economy. With the Ansarullah resistance movement the topic of discussion around the world, some erroneously calling it an Iranian proxy, it's necessary to put things into proper perspective. The analysis of Ansarullah, known in the West as Houthis, and its relations with the Islamic Republic is often not understood outside the political discourse known as sponsor proxy. This doctrine questions the autonomy of the Yemeni group by dubbing it as a tool in the hands of Iran. According to this Western doctrine, Iran as a state uses its power to control the Yemeni group. This is a political relationship based on a revolutionary vision articulated around Islam between the Islamic Republic as a defender of oppressed nations worldwide and the Yemeni resistance group. Ansarullah's rejection of Saudi interference in the country is explained by the sense of oppression and absence of justice that the people of Yemen felt and complained about for years. It was precisely this rejection, anchored in a political dimension with Islamic origins, which explains the repeated uprisings against the former Saudi-backed government in Yemen between 2004 and 2010. In 2011, the grievances of the Yemeni population reached a critical point, leading to massive protests demanding the resignation of President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had ruled the country with an iron hand for over 30 years. After Saleh's exit, Saudi Arabia backed Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi as the new leader of the Arab country, Ansarullah and the people of Yemen rejected his election and launched a popular uprising against the new Saudi-backed government, which was followed by the Saudi-led coalition's aggression. Since 2015, the Ansarullah-led government has been administering the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, as well as most of the Red Sea coast, and has followed a pragmatic foreign policy driven by regional interest. The Yemeni government has particularly opposed the presence of foreign forces in the region, including the United States, and strongly advocated the liberation of Palestine from the Zionist occupation. In this regard, it's important to understand that Yemen's support for the Palestinian cause is not limited to the Ansarullah group's unflinching support for the Palestinian cause. As early as 1947, the then British colony of Aden, southern Yemen, one of the first public demonstrations against British rule, took the form of a three-day strike against Britain's pro-Zionist policies in Palestine. The following year, Yemen became one of the early members of the United Nations. Its delegation joined representatives from five other Arab states in leaving the UN General Assembly Hall when the vote for the partition of Palestine was passed. It can be said, therefore, that the issue of Palestine has served as an anti-colonial catalyst throughout Yemen's contemporary history. For instance, during its 27 years of existence, the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen consistently supported Palestinian movements, with a particular emphasis on left-wing Palestinian organizations. In 1971, it allowed the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine to attack an Israeli ship in Bab el-Mandab. 2 years later, it closed the Bab el-Mandab to Israeli maritime traffic to assist Egypt in the war against the Zionist regime. In 1979, when Egyptian leader Anwar Sadat recognized the Zionist regime and signed the Camp David Accords, the response from PDRY included the expulsion of Egyptian teachers from the country, except for those from the Egyptian left-wing opposition. After the unification of Yemen in 1990, Saleh's regime continued to recognize and support Palestine. In 2015, after the involvement of foreign states in the Arab country, the situation changed. Factions backed by Saudi Arabia and the UAE continued to support the Palestinian Authority based in Ramallah, while the Ansarullah resistance movement and the government it runs has strongly backed Palestinian resistance groups such as Hamas and Islamic Jihad. This support from the Yemeni group for Palestinian resistance groups serves to explain the importance of identity in political terms in order to understand the relations between Iran and Ansarullah.
The history of the land of Palestine.
Part 5.
As I look to the north, I see the fertile plains of Syria and Lebanon. In the east, the vast and bountiful valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates. And in the west, the land of the Egyptians. These were the words spoken by Menachem Begin, the former Prime Minister of Israel. However, his words were in contradiction with the previous discourse of the Zionists. Previously, the Zionists spoke of exile, the Holocaust, and oppression. But after formation of Israel, their language and speech changed. They utilized a new terminology.